was Ed McLean on 22nd December 73.
Yeah, they had they published on Cassiopeia and gave a little bit more refined value to Tau, I think, in the holes. And, also had Taurus, and I believe another source. I'm not sure, not positive, but they had additional information.
Collector Center.
Yeah, possibly so. I don't.
Yeah, I think they
really
had those three.
That.
Yeah.
It's been quite a few years ago, but anyhow.
That was published in 57, though. That was still. Or 56, maybe.
Well, it was a year. It was, I think, the next publication on the subject.
Yeah, but it was at least a year later,
but,
I think.
It probably was. It was a more refined piece of work in that they had a larger instrument and therefore could get me more detail so that when one wanted to look for detail or the latest word on what the holes looked like, it usually got quoted. But I don't think basically the paper added anything to the method as far as that goes. So
that was the first thing, non-solar thing, that was done on the 50-foot dish. Is that right?
Well, I kind of hate to make that a definite yes because I might be
short-circuiting
somebody, but it's the first thing I really remember, solar or lunar, one of the two.
The 21-centimeter continuum and the 10-centimeter continuum.
Well, now, we did some 21-centimeter continuum simultaneously with the galactic center part.
Simultaneously, I see.
There was a letter to the editor, I believe, published in the IRE, proceedings of the IRE. This was simply a number of sources with the temperature at 1400.
That was with Nan Dieter.
Possibly.
I think.
Yeah,
that
I believe
time
it may
Hepburn.
Well have been, yeah. Nan was in on some of the later absorption work. As a matter of fact, I remember we were still hassling over what the mechanism was, and this, I believe, was... couldn't have been Cassiopeia. It was regarded like Galactic Center, I guess. And it was a question of who was going to Ann Arbor to give the talk to AAS. And rather than Hagen or I, either one going, he decided that Nan would go. And I remember calling her up at home, and I said, "Nan, for heaven's sakes, I don't care what John told you." I said, "It's got to be absorption. It's not anything else."
He remained unconvinced, you mean, for a while.
John?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about unconvinced, but not convinced,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, like I say, it's one of those things. Looking back, it's real easy to say, well, anybody, any fool should have known that, but it... It isn't that easy.
No, there are a lot of things like that. Yeah.
So anyhow, Nan went out and gave the talk, and I guess she decided it toward absorption. I'm pretty sure she did. But anyhow, you know, there's still a big controversy at home, I guess.
Yeah.
But Cassiopeia straightened it all out anyhow.
So what was the next thing you worked on in radio astronomy after that?
I don't remember. Well, Ed had come down by that time. We looked at some other sources, but again, we were pretty well strapped with a 50-foot diameter. We couldn't contribute much. The Dutch, I guess, by this time had probably published their thing with their what was it, 80-foot or
25-meter
dish, and so they could outdo us on that. Fred Haddock, now wait a minute, we may have short-circuited Fred Haddock, I guess along about the same time that we started, I guess after we got the dish straightened out, Fred did some 10-centimeter continuum work too.
Right.
And published that. And Fred also did H2 regions, which
right. That was, the first
was
detection
a pretty good go-around for him on the first detection of H2 regions at, by radio astronomy, I guess
right.
You would say, 10 centimeters. So this was a nice piece of work. This kind of thing continued on. I'm trying to remember what Ed and I got involved with. I don't know. We had to write papers for Scientific American and stuff like this, you know, which is always these kind of, I guess you'd call them diversions, but meetings to go to. But, well... About that time, Al Barrett came down, I guess, and he and Ed got together and were going to work on OH.
Right.
And also in 56, I was named acting branch head, which meant, you know, this kind of, I had to kind of divorce myself. So he and Ed got together and were working on OH, and by an unhappy set of circumstances, didn't find it, and, which Al later found that when he went up to MIT. And Ed and I had our famous redshift experiment.
Oh, yes.
Which I'm going down in the annals of astronomy, I guess, as one of the larger bricks that were dropped. Although it had its good aspects, it created fantastic interest in large dishes.
That's right. And, well, that was one of your justifications for the Sugar Grove.
No, thing. I don't think. Really, it might have been in the early stages of Sugar Grove.
I mean, the idea was that it could operate at 21 centimeters, though, and that you could detect
these.
Oh, we
wanted to operate at 10 centimeters, but and it would have, if it was successful. But we were really suckered in by statistics, I guess, because I don't know how many thousand measurements we made, and we lumped a red mean and a blue mean together, and then we lumped the stuff in the middle, and I don't know how many people we had go over with it. I know Connie Mary went over all the data. I think Fred Haddock went over all the data. And if you took the data and looked at it, there was definitely a depression. It was on Virgo, I guess it was.
Yeah, Virgo. Yeah.
Virgo. Which later proved out to be true.
Yeah.
I mean, it was.
Well,
Australians, I guess.
Carolyn and Robinson, well, but that hasn't been confirmed yet.
Still in doubt?
It's still in doubt. I think most people don't believe it still, because they're...
Well, that's interesting, because Jim Kenny and I, on our own, without any fanfare, went back and tried to repeat the thing on Virgo, and we again thought we had evidence, and we thought we had evidence so strongly that we went up to Harvard and actually used their 21-centimeter measure to do some points up there, and when we got all through, we just decided it wasn't a strong enough case to publish, particularly a second time.
I think it's really undecided, but... this Curler and Robinson was repeated,
yeah.
I can't remember who did that now.
Well, Hagen always referred to it. No, I won't say that. He referred to it as a particular kind of experiment where you know the answer before you begin. You know,
yeah.
It ought to be there. Well, if it's there, it's not an easily detectable
thing.
But
you don't understand what might have gone wrong.
No, because Ed and I repeated the thing on Cygnus again, very carefully, and. You know, it wasn't statistically significant the second time, and we had long discussions about publishing a paper, and he would send me his revised version, I'd revise it and send it back to him, and this went back and forth for quite a few times, and finally I had to do an article for Scientific American, and I mentioned in there that we had repeated the experiment without success, which other people had also done by that time, and that was about as far as the retraction was concerned, and I think we both now wish that we had actually published what we did the second time, but everybody knew what everybody else was doing, and everybody knew that we weren't able to reproduce it. We didn't publish it formally, I guess you'd say.
Right.
We should have, I think. And it's been repeated several times since, unsuccessfully. So, as I said, that was about the biggest brick. One interesting anecdote, Ed was all tooled up with some kind of receiver. I've even forgotten the wavelength now. Well, I believe it was the OH receiver he and Al Barrett were working on. They pointed at the sun, got a beautiful emission line, an absolutely beautiful, perfect profile. So he brought it down to me and he says, hey, what do you think of this? I said, you know, I asked him what the ground rules were, and he told me, I said, well, I don't know, Ed. This was after the redshift, of course. I said, I don't know, but I said, I think we better do something to make sure it's real. And I don't know, we had some tuning mechanisms in the feed horn to get the SWR down, one thing or another, and it was a Cutler feed, I guess it was called, a folds back on itself type thing for a 50-foot dish. And you know, I was just very skeptical at this point. Not skeptical, really, but I really wanted to be sure before they published. So the only thing we could think of to check it out was to build a holerum. So we got umpteen, I don't know how many, 200 or 300 fluorescent bulbs.
Yeah.
Built a box, lined the box with fluorescent bulbs, and stuck the feed inside the box. Took it off the antenna, brought it back over in the lab, you know. Ran the profile and I ran the scan through, and there was a profile. And we never did find out what it was, but it was some extremely high Q, very low coupled thing in the antenna feed, I presume, which you had to have an extremely high temperature.
Yeah.
You know, the order of tens of thousands of degrees to detect. But once you got that high background temperature in there, this little profile of 20 degrees or whatever it was there. So that washed that one out.
Right.
It saved us more embarrassment, at least. But I guess that taught all of us a lesson to be real, real careful. You know, try to get the instrumental blues out if possible, because like this Cygnus occultation I was telling you about, you can't explain these things, but there probably is an explanation other than one that you'd like to have happen with some startling discovery.
When was the Cygnus occultation?
Oh, it was one day. I don't know what the date was. It must have been around the late 50s, early 60s. Jim Kenney and I were at the Maryland Point doing some routine measurements on Cygnus at, in the continuum, I guess. I don't really remember for sure what the experiment was, basically, but everything was set up and working perfectly. The antenna was tracking. We had a switching radiometer. I guess it was continuum because it was continuum switch against the Skyhorn. Both the Skyhorn and the, you know, the square wave switch out of the receiver was displayed on the scope, so we could watch that. The antenna dials were right there and everything, and all of a sudden we were just sitting there tracking Cygnus, and the thing started to go down. The chart recorder started to drop, and the temperature of Cygnus was what, something like 100 degrees perhaps on the antenna.
Right.
And it dropped down to 20, 30 degrees in a very slow, methodical, deliberate fashion, and slowly, in the same methodical fashion, came back up. And we had enough time over a period of maybe 30, 40 seconds to a minute to actually check everything in the building as far as instrumentation was concerned, and it was actually, as far as we could determine, a true diminution in the temperature of Cygnus. But you stop and try to figure out something that can physically do this in the way of a satellite or a star or something like this occulting it, and you come up against a stone wall. There's no tidy explanation, and we talked to a lot of our buddies about should we publish this, and we finally decided that we wouldn't, that it was probably a fluke of some sort, but it's always bothered me because it actually did happen. We had no explanation for it. It looked like a true occultation by something, and yet there was nothing that one could come up with that looked real. There weren't any stars occulting it or anything. Any obvious objects, let's put it that way. Unless, nowadays maybe you'd look for a black hole, but in those days we didn't know about those.
For some reason. Well, but how would a power supply do that?
No, I don't. We went through all these possibilities, and as I say, this was a single channel receiver with a switch on a Skyhorn, and it was too smooth. It wasn't anything erratic. It wasn't a bad connection or anything of this sort. As far as we could determine, looking at the switching scopes that were displaying the switching waveforms out of the receiver, there was no question but what. It wasn't the question of the Skyhorn increasing in temperature, it was a question of Cygnus decreasing in temperature.
Yeah. That's right, of course that would be another possibility.
We had time to check this, you see.
Yeah.
And we were both firmly convinced that for whatever reason, the temperature of Cygnus actually dropped.
Hmm.
We checked the antenna dials, the position was correct, we jotted down the time and the declination and right ascension and all this, so that we had at leisure and then a time with leisure to check everything, and we were right on it. There was no question about that. It wasn't a hang up in the tracking system.
Really strange.
Because, if a gear had hung up or something like that, you'd expect it to show some sort of erratic behavior. But this was very smooth. We analyzed the profile, if you will, and there was no explanation. It never came up before. So,
well, what about the Sugar Grove dish?
This, of course, was a fond hope and dream. Following, we built the 84-foot dish, of course.
Yeah, that's right. We
had that, which was good for hydrogen line absorption, things of this sort, but other people did too. Ours, we completed ours first, I think, but Haddock had one out at Michigan. And, there were several of them.
Right.
It was a common size. And quite independently, two groups at NRL got interested in big dishes. One was a group working on electronic countermeasures, and ourselves, who were interested in big radio telescopes. And it turned out that both our needs could be fit by a single instrument, and we got very ambitious and decided to see what could be done about something in the 500 or 600-foot range. And we finally came up with essentially two studies. One done by Jim Trexler's group, which basically was a servoed panel system, where the surface panels would be servoed by some method or other to a parabola. Turned out eventually they used light beams or infrared beams from a rigid member in the middle of the dish, which would locate all the corners of all the pad, all the panels. But we had an alternate proposal by the fellow who did the 50-foot dish, where you'd use a control structure, which was an entirely new idea. That is, you would put the major strength members and the structural members in the thing under strain, and then either increase or decrease the strain, depending on what a pilot control rod down the center of the member would tell you to do. So we had the two proposals. One I would call a control structure, and the other was called a control surface. So we finally broke these out of NRL and took them over to the Bureau of Yards and Docks. Unfortunately, not that the Bureau of Yards and Docks isn't a fine organization, and they build very fine yards and very fine docks and all that sort of thing, but they don't build scientific instruments, and that's really what we had. And it was a rather chilling experience to find out that here we had two designs, both of which depended on servo mechanisms, and the chief engineers at the Bureau of Yards and Docks didn't really know what a servo was, and he looked at me as an upstart kid, and he looked over at me and said, "Are you an engineer?" Well, it so happens I do have an engineering degree. Yeah. I said, "Yeah, I'm an engineer." And he said, "What kind?" I said, "Electrical." And he said, "Well, I thought so." You know, this kind of thing. He was an older man and wasn't going to be having his young kids tell him how to build anything, you know.
Anything that was that big had to be pretty solid.
As far as he's concerned, it's like a skyscraper or a bridge or a yard or a dock.
Right.
And in actuality, it was a very precise scientific instrument which depended on servo mechanisms to keep it in trim. Well, the NRL, essentially, what happened in short was NRL lost control of it as far as being able to say what should and shouldn't be done, or at least
because it was deemed to be too large a project.
Yeah, it was not so much too large a project, but too large perhaps, out of our province, you know, big money, big structure, and somebody else, NRL, just didn't do things like this. So they finally awarded the contract to a consortium, and it was really a sad experience because you could see all these very qualified civil engineers working their fanny off, you know, trying to build this thing, design it and build it.
What was the final design, by the way? Which method won out?
Well, the servo panels, Battelle Memorial Institute did a very good study on this, and they were going to set this very rigid thing made of Invar, I believe, in the middle of the, on the axis, and from this you'd have chopped light beams or chopped infrared beams going out to panels, and you would then control the whole parabolic surface from this one hard structure in the middle. But they let the contract to these people who normally, I guess, build yards and docks, and they got all very enthused, and we went to a lot of meetings, and they were all very qualified civil engineers, but they never quite understood, I don't think, what they were dealing with. And not only that, the military applications had a lot of priority, and in fact, the money would never have been allocated for the project if it hadn't been for the military side of it. So the scientific side was kind of taking a free ride, you might say. But Jim Trexler's side of it, they were in as much trouble as we were because they lost control and lost the ability to have input, call a halt when they thought something was going wrong. So what happened, the contractors just immediately started laying foundation and are ordering steel. See, it was a railroad track type thing. It had a big panel bearing in the middle with a circular railroad track, and bogies or trucks would run around it to support this thing, and two huge Ferris wheels for the declination axis. And they started ordering steel for the structure just above the trucks and the panel bearing and all this business before anybody had ever designed anything up at the feed point. Well, you know what happens. You add a pound at the feed point, and you end up with 10 or 20 or 100 pounds down on the lowest member.
Yeah.
So the foundation got designed and the steel ordered and a lot of it delivered before anybody ever got a final figure on what it was going to have to support. And they had to back off then and redo it. And, I guess at the end, Jim and I were hassling with each other about how many feed capsules we needed, you know, and have rapid changeover.
Yeah.
Roughly half the time would be available for scientific creation, work, and half for military. So we had to have rapid changeover. We had to keep these modules down to some reasonable weight. And even at the very end, you see, we were still not quite sure what the weight was going to be at the feed point. And they were already on their second go-around on the foundation. Well, to make a long story short, McNamara got a hold of it in 63, I guess, and decided this was one of the things the Navy could do without, or the military could do without. And he called PSAC up. Jerry Wiesner was head of PSAC then. Ed Purcell was set up with a committee to study the scientific potential. And Purcell's committee certainly didn't condemn it, but again, in a way, they kind of condemned it with faint praise. They said, well, it might be worth $40 million. Well, already the price was up to $200 million, and some people were saying $300 or $400 million, you know, which doesn't sound like all that much today, but back then it was it was two or three times that
still
much.
A hell of a lot,
still a lot of money, and still way, way more than it should have cost, by the way. At one point, I heard one of the contractors say to another one, and I can't remember the names, thank goodness, but he said, you know, any project this size can have its cost doubled. You know, it was this sort of thing.
Very simply. What did it start out at?
Control was just completely lost at the time.
Yeah. What did it start out at the cost?
I think today it could have been built. Now, not counting all the military aspects of it. In other words, they were going to have a crew of people in blue suits out there to do the military intelligence work. Maybe 100 or 200 people, something like that. So not discounting all that stuff. We're just talking about an antenna.
Right.
I'd said 50, 60 million, and I think 75 million at the outside for a radio telescope of that size and design.
Could be built today for that, you're saying?
No, then.
That was the original.
At that time, had we not run into, you might say, bad management.
Yeah.
And unfortunate decisions that were made, and discounting the overhead, which the military function would entail. The antenna could have been built, I'm sure, for 50 to 75 million, which is what we said in the first place. And after it was all over and canceled, I've forgotten who it was, one of the consulting engineers in New York, and I had lunch together, and he agreed with me still. I said, if this thing hadn't been, I hadn't gotten in trouble, he said, I still believe that we could build it for 50, 60, 70 million.
And how much did it get spent to
fund? Over 100 million, I'm sure, and or in the order of 100 million, and nothing was up, and a lot of steel on the ground, and surface panels were made, beautiful surface panels, where quite a few of those were made. And the pintle bearing was in, the tracks were in.
I suppose the foundation is still there.
I don't know what happened to the steel for the foundation. The panels were up for grabs. I know.
No, I mean the concrete.
The concrete, the pintle bearing is still the biggest single bearing, I think, in the eastern Mississippi, if not the entire United States. It's a monster. But it's still there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
There would be no way, really, to get it out of there, I suppose.
Wouldn't be worth the effort.
But some of the steel was sold off. There may still be some of it there. The surface panels were up for grabs. Several of us thought about it, maybe putting them together as a fixed dish, you know, or
a hole in the ground or something.
Yeah, a hole in the ground or something of this sort, but nothing ever came of that as far as I know. So they probably ended up on a scrap heap somewhere. But it was, in a way, a very fun experience, in a way, a very bitter experience, because it caused us at NRL to lose 3 or 4 years of work, really.
Yeah. This was our major effort.
This was our major effort, and everything we did in the way, not only of our day-to-day radio astronomy, but all our plans for instrumentation, all our plans for personnel, everything hinged around this project. Mm. And my one hope was to, well, there was no question what it was available roughly 50% of the time for science. But before it collapsed, we'd set up a committee of outsiders to come in and try to do some scientific planning for the thing, very similar to what NRAO ended up doing with a visiting committee and whatnot.
Right.
But I think this should have been done at an earlier stage, but again, there was a military security aspect of it, and it just seemed that nothing went quite right. Everything, you might say, went wrong.
Right.
Although, today, I'm still convinced that dish could have been built for $50 to $75 million, and it would have been something else again. But now, look at it today from the astrophysical point of view. What really would you do with a dish that size that was good only to 10 centimeters, because most of your chemistry, you might say, is done at shorter wavelengths. So right. you couldn't have used that resolution and gain for that. You could have used it for hydrogen absorption studies, very, very fine fashion.
Could have used it for extragalactic hydrogen.
Yeah.
Very high sensitivity.
Yeah, there are things that, you know, obvious things like that, but it probably wouldn't, well, I shouldn't say this, but as far as I know, it wouldn't have caused any drastic breakthroughs in that part of the spectrum. You would have been able to do things that you already knew how to do in a much finer fashion, no question about that.
So wouldn't but, what you're saying is it wouldn't have changed the course of radio astronomy so much, especially relative to the amount of money put into it? Probably.
Very, very possibly that's the correct statement. Well, it would have been handy for some polarization studies at 10 centimeters, I suppose, on very weak objects, things of this sort. There are a lot of things it could have done. Whether it was worth the price or not, I don't know. I suppose a very large array will be able to do a lot of these things with perhaps not the same collecting area, but certainly more resolution. Of course, with absorption, you get the resolution, but, you know, it's hard to say what might have come out of it. And every time you build a dish, you find things it can do that you didn't know it could do. So, at the time, it seemed like a wise investment. I think the price, if it had been built for as a radio astronomy, as a telescope, at that price, it wouldn't have been excessive.
Yeah.
It would have been one of a kind. I don't think anybody would ever have duplicated it.
No,
and
sure.
Harvard, of course, and their cohorts in the Northeast group up there have postulated something pretty close to it under a radome.
And Lovell also was trying to get a 450 foot or something.
So I think it was still a proper thing to do. I don't think it was wrong to try it. It was just very unfortunate that it hit all the rough spots, it seemed like. Well,
so when that ended, then...
When that ended, we were badly deflated, you might say. Everything we had done for the past 3 years or so had been pointed toward that. So we had several meetings in the branch and tried to decide what we could do. So we finally decided the best thing we could do was to build 85 feet, for example, was a pretty standard size, but nobody had one that would really go to short wavelengths. So we decided probably the smartest thing we could do would build a build an 85-foot dish that had a peak gain of somewhere around 1 centimeter. That would be a real good dish at 1 centimeter.
Take advantage of your short wavelength expertise again.
Again, yeah. What we knew best, plus the fact that nobody else had one. And same argument on a 600. What do you do if you cut off at 10 centimeters? There are beginning to be rumblings of molecular lines and things of this sort. Water vapor and all this kind of business. People had already looked for them, I think, without success.
A few predictions and so forth.
But it looked like a proper direction to go. An 85-foot dish is something we can handle in the branch. We figured the cost would be under $1 million, which is something we could manage, you know, without undue strain in our group. So I went over to Page and I laid it out for him and told him, you know, in view of the demise of the 600-foot... Well, there was one little thing happened before that. There was a period when NRL was going to try to save the 600-foot and perform a holding action, I guess you would say. And they wanted to move the whole radio astronomy branch to Sugar Grove.
I see.
And I don't know. I don't think I did myself any good, but I asked everybody what they thought. Nobody was much in favor of it, and I was dead set against it.
Yeah.
I thought it was the most stupid thing we could do to cut ourselves off. Which NRAO was going through the same problem right then, and they finally moved back to Charlottesville. I couldn't see doing the opposite. But it sure took some strong backbone to stand up to everybody else at NRL, because they wanted us out there as a kind of a guard in place, I guess, to guard the bearing.
The hostages out there.
Yeah.
All these people are there.
Make sure nobody stole the bearing, you know. So anyhow... We rode that one over, and then things kind of settled down. While we're paced, I said, look, we got to do something if we're going to stay in business. And I think the smartest thing we can do is build the best 85-foot dish that American expertise can build. And he says, what's it going to cost? I said, I don't know, but it's going to be a lot more than the last 85 or 84 we had.
Yeah.
And I guess we estimated somewhere around between $500,000 and $1 million. So we... And a lot of credit on this project goes to Bob Meyer, who was the contract officer on this one. I was the contract officer, scientific officer, they call it, on the 84. But I turned that over to him on the 85, and he did a lot of awfully good work in checking mechanical design performance, or Rohr's performance on the contract. So we had we wrote up performance specifications. We'd already seen things go down the drain with trying to tell people how to build things. So we just wrote a set of performance specifications. What we wanted is the size, of course, but what we wanted it to do when it was finally built. That is, how accurate the tracking was supposed to be, how accurate the surface was supposed to be, how it was to perform off the vertical axis, everything we can think of as far as performance was concerned. Right. And then we didn't tell anybody how to do this. We just put it out on bid. And it shook down to Bob Hall's former place of employment and his then-present place of employment, that is Blown Ox Corporation and Rohr Corporation, who built the San Francisco subway. So Bob had built the Blown Ox dish when he was there, the one that Michigan had, for example, case in point. So he bid it, and Blown Ox bid it, and the two designs were so close that it wasn't even funny. I mean, it was really a problem for us to decide between the two because they were within a fantastically small sum on price. I don't know which one had to spy and the other ones can't, but it had to be pretty close, you know.
Yeah.
But the fact that he had been at Blown Ox and the fact that he was in at Rohr, Bob Hall, that is, the couch for it. I don't think there was any chicanery or anything of that sort. But it was a very close thing. And it got down to the point where I was firing telegrams off to one and saying, what will you guarantee us on tracking within 45 degrees of zenith? Right. Duplicate telegrams to both companies. And after four or five of these things, you know, I had some basis to make a choice. Because one of them would guarantee a little more than the other. Well, Bob Hall stuck his neck out a little farther than Blown Ox did. But other than that, it was a dead heat. And as far as I know, Blown Ox might have done as good a job as Rohr did. But anyhow, we had a performance spec. And there were some shaky moments while the thing was building. At one point, somebody had under-designed the bolts up the top of the polar axis or something, and they had to go in while half the structure was up and do a fix on this. Yeah. But after it was all said and done, I guess it turned out to be one of the best, finest mirrors in the world.
Yeah. So there were...
I found out from entirely independent means that the military purpose of the Sugar Grove dish was to monitor Soviet radio traffic that bounced off the moon, but not to intercept individual messages, but rather just the general level of the UHF and VHF communications. The idea being that preparations for an attack, that there'd be a great increase in the amount of radio traffic, and this would show up as a brightness increase on what was reflected off the moon, and this could be picked up by the 600-foot dish. And so that was the guiding idea of this whole thing. So that ends the interview with Ed McLean on 22nd December 73 at his home in Morningside, Maryland.